This is Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Today we're playing some of our best one-on-one conversations, or actually in our case, two-on-one conversations that Marjorie and I have had over the past year. Former mayor and ambassador to the Vatican, Ray Flynn, weighs in on the future of Boston under new mayoral leadership. He also has high hopes for the future of the Catholic Church with Pope Francis at the helm. From there, Harvard Business School historian Nancy Kane looks at what could be the next social movement, animal liberation.
Then we'll talk to Governor Mike Dukakis about high-speed rail and how he's making 80 years old the new 20. And we wrap up with a very candid interview with Mayor Tom Menino on his love for the city and how he's making the transition from urban mechanic to a university bigwig. That's next on Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio. Today we're bringing you some of our best open mic moments from over the year. We're kicking things off with former Governor Michael Dukakis. He dropped by WGBH to talk transportation, healthcare, and his secret to being an 80-year-old going on 20. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us for a special edition of Open Mic is former Massachusetts governor and 1988 Democratic Party nominee for president. He's now a professor of political science at Northeastern University. Happy belated 80th birthday, Michael Dukakis. How are you, Governor?
The young reformer is 80. I can't
That's
get
right.
used to this.
It is. Oh, it's shocking.
Why don't you
for
tell people what you were complaining about the second you walked into the studio in a classic Dukakis fashion?
Well, as you both know, I'm an old WGBH hand and had a wonderful experience moderating The Advocates back in the early 70s for folks who are old enough to remember back then. And, of course, we were over on Western Avenue. And this is the first time, actually, I haven't done this kind of thing by television. Only for you guys would I come here.
We were very sweet to
but
do it.
But where's the tea? I mean, it's over in East Overshoe
someplace.
That's
right. It is far away. So we should tell people – well, you should tell people, actually, in case they don't know this. Jim just mentioned Governor Dukakis that you teach at Northeastern. You also are lucky enough to spend the winters out teaching in Los Angeles.
It's tough, but somebody's got to do it.
But for people that don't know this, and I do know this because I was stalking you once outside your house on Perry Street to do a story for the Herald, what you do in the morning on the way to work to Northeastern, what do you do every morning when you
walk?
Well, I walk. You walk. But you do something special on your walk.
Well, I love parks, as you know.
Yes.
I love parks. I was very distressed by the way our state park system was being run under my Republican successors. Fortunately, under the Patrick administration, there's been a tremendous improvement in things. But I love the Emerald Necklace. I'm on the Emerald Necklace Conservancy board these days. So I try to clean the place up. And these days, I'm working a little less because it's being maintained. And if you're interested, I'll tell you how. But in the meantime, I think I love Boston. It really is now a beautiful city, and we just got to keep it that way. And somebody once said, if everybody in Boston picked up one piece of litter a day, the place would be immaculate.
Yeah, you picked up about 40 pieces of litter a
day. Well, I carry a plastic bag. Of course,
he carries a plastic bag. It's great.
Brookline's going to outlaw him, so I guess I'll have to carry a paper bag or something.
That's
so,
right.
Governor, long before there was Obamacare and long before there was Romney care, there was
Dukakis
Michael Dukakis care. On the steps of the State House in 1988.
Indeed.
Universal health care comes to Massachusetts. It was short-lived. What are the lessons you draw from both the passage and the disappearance that you think would be useful
of the bill
to
that I signed?
Yeah, to be useful to the president right now who's struggling with this Affordable Care Act.
He's going to be fine. We can get into that in a second. But actually, our bill was a state version of Richard Nixon's bill, which had already been passed at the state level by one state and one state only, and that was Hawaii, 1975. And the bill that I signed essentially was a Massachusetts version of the Nixon bill, which basically said all employers and employees will have to contribute to health insurance at the workplace. No exchanges, none of this kind of stuff. And we'll expand Medicaid a little bit to cover people that are temporarily unemployed. That was the Nixon plan. And, you know, if Ted Kennedy were here today, Jim, he'd say the worst political mistake he made in his entire career was not enjoining Nixon right away in that bill. But he didn't want the insurance companies involved. He wanted basically universal
single
Medicare.
Payer,
yeah. And then in early 73, he finally decided the votes weren't going to be there for universal Medicare. So got to go to work with the Nixon administration. And in fact, Stu Altman, who's currently at Brandeis, been there for a long time, was the young assistant
and running the governor's health care advisory, whatever it's called.
Well, he was a young assistant secretary at what we called HEW in those days, and he's the guy that began to go to work on the bill. And then Watergate hit, and that was the end of Nixon, and that was the end of Nixon's plan. So the bill I signed was essentially a state copy. So what happened? We made a mistake. We provided a three-year phase-in period. And I completed my third and last term and left office with a year to go in that phase-in. In comes Bill Weld. Bright guy, but he never understood health care and did everything he could to screw it up, and unfortunately he was successful. So we implemented some of it. People that are unemployed get health care in Massachusetts. Always did, even before Romney Care. Students and their families. But we never fully implemented the bill. It took another 20 years to finally get a plan, which now is working really quite well here.
We're talking with Governor Michael Dukakis. You just said, Governor, because some of us, including myself, are worried about this, that there's been such criticism and such problems with the affordable health care, including the fact that young people are going to be able to keep some of their plans, which kind of takes away the underpinning of the financing. You're not worried that it's going to be done away with once Obama leaves office?
No.
Why not?
Because we'll enroll so many people. And by the way, and I think it's important to say this, Marjorie, and I don't think either the White House or the congressional Democrats have done a very good job of saying this, and I say this with great humility because anybody who can win the presidency twice is a much better communicator than a guy that ran once and lost, and you're talking to him. 85% of the uninsured people in this country are working or members of working families. They're not sitting around. They're not loafing. They're not on welfare. If you're on welfare, you get Medicaid. These are working Americans.
Yep.
No health care or terrible health care. And I think that's the message, and we really haven't delivered it. Yes, it's nice to get rid of pre-existing conditions, nice to keep your kids on until they're 26, but the central message here is that working Americans ought to have decent, affordable health care. And by the way, if you went out and took a poll tomorrow and asked the American people, should working Americans and their families have decent, affordable health care, 93% say yes. And we haven't been saying this. You know, half the people in this country think this is another welfare program. It isn't.
But Governor, isn't Marjorie right that by agreeing to this, maybe he had no choice after Bill Clinton suggested he, quote, honor his promise, isn't the allowing people who have individual coverage to go back and take their canceled policy, which mostly people say is going to be young, healthy people, which was going to help balance the cost— isn't the – you had the word affordable in there. Isn't the word affordable going to disappear from at least the early stages of this?
Take a look at what's happening in California right now. Young people are signing up in greater percentages than they anticipated, and they're getting very good health care at, in most cases, substantially less cost. So I'm not troubled by that. I'm obviously troubled by the fact that the information system isn't working the way it should, except in the states that are moving ahead with this thing. And that, of course, is the direct result of a terrible Supreme Court decision, notwithstanding the result. A terrible Supreme Court decision that somehow came up with a notion that the federal government apparently can't impose conditions on the money it gives to the states. Have you ever heard anything like this? This is coercion. This is some kind of constitutional doctrine I never heard of. Look, we have hundreds and hundreds of federal grant and aid programs in the states. They set conditions. You don't want to meet the conditions, you don't get the money. Somehow, this Supreme Court, including Roberts, by the way, in this part of the decision,
Chief Justice,
decides that the states ought to decide whether or not they're going to insure people and extend Medicaid. And that has complicated things. But, you know, they're going to straighten it out. I mean, I said to somebody the other day, he said, you know, the government's going to... I said, well, you know, Boeing hasn't gotten the software on its battery on the Dreamliner right yet. It's been 3 years. I mean, these things happen.
Yeah.
And I'm not criticizing Boeing. So we'll you know, they're going to straighten it out, and millions of people, working Americans and their families, are going to finally get decent, affordable health care. And when that happens, it's going to be impossible for the Republicans to turn around and repeal this thing.
You know, there was another great story that people have been talking about for days, and they had a piece in the Herald today talking about it, too, the Olympics coming to Boston. The Herald was saying it was going to cost $15 billion, which, new stadium, new swimming facility, and all that kind of thing. What do you think about the Olympics coming
here? I'm skeptical.
You are?
Yeah.
For the money part?
Look, I love this city. It's doing great. We have other needs serious needs, including, by the way, connecting North and South Station by rail. I just wanted to get that in.
You know. We're going to talk about rails because you guys are both upset.
And other things we want to talk about.
No, but he's talking about an older proposal.
And I'm just skeptical. Look, I'm a big fan. Look, I'm Greek. I'm a Greek-American. I love the Olympics.
What can I
tell you? It all began with us, right? But that's a huge investment in a city which these days is doing exceedingly well, with the exception of affordable housing, which we've got to get to work on. And I just don't know. Do we need a huge Olympic stadium?
Okay.
I'm a skeptic. I'm not saying no. I'm just...
So if you're skeptical about whether or not we need a huge Olympic stadium, are you skeptical about whether or not we need a huge gambling palace in Everett or in Springfield or in the – why are you not
I'm in the minority, but I'm just not a fan of
– Why is that?
Because I think it's a lousy economic strategy for this state. I don't think you gain a lot net unless, of course, people start pouring in here. And since we're being surrounded now by – all kinds of states that either have casino gambling or want it and are going to get it. I think the net gain is going to be minimal at best, Jim. It means another 100,000 gambling addicts. We've got enough addiction in this state and across this country without adding more. And I just don't think that's the kind of economic strategy that is worthy of this state. We've got great assets. We've got the opportunity to create economic opportunity for every citizen in the state, and I'm just not a fan of it.
But you are a fan of the governor who enthusiastically signed on to this, even though he told us last, I think it was Thursday, he was in the studio with us, and he said, quote, "I'm sick of this." And he didn't mean the underlying law. When I asked him what he meant, he said, "I'm sick," after every vote, people asking, is this the end or is this?
Yeah.
Why did Deval Patrick, who's a pretty enlightened soul, sign on to this, do you think, Governor?
You'd have to ask him. And you know, I'm a fan of the governor's and quite supportive of him in many, many ways. When you're down economically, as we were, and as the country was, you're looking for things that conceivably might add to that. And at that time, I think it wasn't unreasonable for him to take a good hard look at this, although, as you know, it's a very tough, highly regulated operation, which is making life very difficult for some of these casino operators.
You're not troubled by that. I mean, if we're going to have them, that level of regulation and scrutiny,
I think you've got to be tough
as
nails. And I'm a great fan of Steve Crosby's and the folks that he appointed.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't beat Crosby when it comes to being a tough, honest regulator who's going to insist on the very best kind of operator. But I'm just not a fan of this stuff. I think we have far greater opportunities to build a really strong and effective economic future for everybody in this state than casinos.
We're talking with former Governor Michael Dukakis, who, of course, was our governor. He ran for president. He was also in the state legislature for a little bit of time. I'm wondering what you think. I mean, Tom Menino was stepping down in January, very popular mayor in the city of Boston. What do you think were his biggest strengths as the mayor? Maybe any weaknesses that you think he might have been better at?
Well, it's interesting, Marjorie. I remember being asked to moderate a debate with the 8 candidates for mayor.
When
Tom ran for the first time. Remember, he was the acting
mayor because
he had been the president of the city council.
And Ray Flynn left to go to the Vatican.
Right. And Ray went to the Vatican. And there were 8 of them. And if you would ask people at that time, what do you think about Menino? You know, he can't speak, he can't do this, that. What is it about Tom? He's got, for one thing, he's got absolute integrity. I mean, you know, this is 20 years.
No corruption.
You know, better than that. I mean, this is 20 years without a whisper of corruption, lack of integrity, and so on. I mean, he cares very deeply about this. But he's got an instinct for this town. I mean, he just has something very special. And it started when he was a city councilor, and he got very much involved in the Main Streets movement, which was attempting to revive those neighborhood shopping areas like Rosendale Square and Fields Corner and those places when, you know, it was all about downtown. But I tell you, I'm a big fan of Tom Menino's, and while I'd like to think a few of the rest of us contributed something to all of this renaissance, you have to say that he's been an extraordinary mayor. And the only way I can describe it is that he just has an instinct for this city, what it is, its history, its future, and with a better fart.
Can we talk about trains? Because Jim just wrote a terrific piece about high-speed rail in the Boston Globe
magazine.
Yes, you did. I don't know, Governor Dukakis, are we ever going to see high-speed rail from here to New York City or Washington or Philadelphia?
Marjorie,
or even to Maine, where you just went on a train?
This country has to make a decision. Do we really need 837 American military bases in 150 countries decades after the end of the Cold War? Or might we get along with maybe 300 American bases in 60 countries? Yeah. I'm serious.
No, you're right.
Now, those bases cost billions. Invading Iraq cost us $10 billion a month. What's the president asking for? $10 billion a year to invest in what? In modern high-speed rail before the rest of the world goes right by us. And as Jim pointed out in his piece yesterday, I mean, they're going right by us.
They are. It's depressing.
And we're still putzing along, with some exceptions, at 80 miles an hour, which we were doing 100 years ago.
Is that a legal term of art, putzing along? Is that you learned that at law school? Was that a law school
Harvard
thing?
Law school. Harvard Law School.
But, you know, Governor, here's my thesis that I have applied to virtually everything with great depression on my part, which is why I worry. You're an Amtrak, been an Amtrak board member, no greater advocate for rail in this country. And by the way, if the governor had his way, we'd get to New York City in 90 minutes.
Right.
That's the plan,
Amtrak
plan. My feeling, I don't care if it's Social Security, Amtrak, whatever the issue is, I think the vast majority of elected officials make this calculation, even if it's not conscious. Is this thing going to fall apart while I'm still in office? Are the 100-year-old water mains beneath the streets going to explode now, or will they wait 10 years? And if they believe Social Security, rail, water mains are going to last until they're in the private sector, the vast majority of people aren't willing to take the personal risk to say we got to invest in this stuff. Is that an unfair statement?
I think it's unfair.
Why?
Look, well, some people in politics take a short-term view. On the other hand, we put $4.5 billion into cleaning up the Boston Harbor, didn't we? We had to raise fees.
That's true.
A lot of people were upset. I mean, we were paying nothing. You know, we're actually borrowing to keep water fees low at that time. Can you imagine this? So my water bill in Brookline went from $200 to $800. I wasn't happy about it. But look at Boston Harbor today, not just as a beautiful place, Jim, but the economy of the harbor has just exploded.
But didn't the judge have some role to play in that?
Yes, the judge had some role to play, but if I may say...
Oh, I'm not belittling.
You know,
me,
and a few other people did too, because as a matter of fact, it was the EPA and my former classmate Bill Ruckelshaus, who was the EPA administrator, who basically said to me, I called him, I said, look, tell me what you're going to do with this thing. He said, well, we're going to insist that you do what is called secondary treatment. It's a lot more expensive than primary treatment. I said, okay, that's all I want to know. So we invested $4.5 billion in that project, on time, under budget, unlike another well-known public works project about which we'll say very little. I wasn't the governor to cut the ribbon on the project, but, I mean, those are the kinds of things that you're elected to do.
But, Governor, it seems to me, if I were to say, if the major investment, infrastructure investments in this country, I may be off by one. I would say that high-speed rail should be near the top of the list for all the reasons you stated.
Top of the list.
Most of which I tried to get in this piece, from the environment to it being weatherproof, to it getting goods to market quickly, to being, can be all these sort of things. But with the exception of Jerry Brown, who is fighting relentlessly for this out there in California, even governors, the Republican governors, are rejecting money. Many Democratic governors have it very low on the spectrum. I mean, is it a high enough priority to be real anyway? I know the Obama administration put aside billions of dollars, but the conventional wisdom is Ray LaHood, his Secretary of Transportation, did not do a very good job spending the money.
No, LaHood was very good, Jim. I mean, LaHood was very good.
But a lot of the money that's being spent, Governor, I think
it's gone. Look, the Congress appropriated $8 billion as a down payment on this. You know how many – what the applications were for high-speed intercity projects? In excess of $100 billion coming from the states and regions. There's an enormous demand for this. But in my view, what are we talking about? $10 billion a month in Iraq. Why aren't we getting it? Well – all of a sudden, trains have become ideological in Congress, which is kind of strange if you know anything about history.
What, you would think the Republicans would be more into high-speed rail than Democrats would be.
It was a Republican president named Abraham Lincoln who, in the middle of the Civil War, and by the way, at a very bad time in the middle of the Civil War, said, we're going to build a transcontinental railroad, which was a plank in the Republican Party platform of 1860. Now, when did trains become a partisan issue? I don't get it.
Well, I'd love to ask you about that, Michael Dukakis, former governor of Massachusetts, because you obviously did run for president, and you're in a perfect place to comment on this. We had this piece in the Globe today talking about how John Kerry and John McCain, who used to be very friendly, they did a lot of work getting POWs and MIAs out of Vietnam, McCain has just called, quote, this guy has been a human wrecking ball, meaning Kerry, and criticized every move he's made as Secretary of State. It kind of gets to that dysfunction in Washington. What I mean, are we ever going to get out of this mess?
Or look, in this case, you just have two people who have had a long background in history, including, you know, military, personal military history, who agree on some things and disagree on others. I mean, McCain is an interventionist. I mean, he wants the United States to be the world sheriff.
Right.
Now, it seems to me clear, A, that we can't do that, and B, we can't afford it even if we could. And I think my former lieutenant governor, didn't I train him well?
You did.
I think this has been extraordinary.
This is John Kerry,
for those
who don't know.
That's right. I almost forgot myself. That's right.
Not only that, we're on our way to a peace conference on Syria.
Right.
Now, I think this is terrific. Don't you?
I do. Well, I do, but I guess the question is—
So what's McCain's problem? I don't know.
Well, I didn't mean to just talk about the two of them.
Is it always going to be partisan?
This whole bigger picture where you wonder what's going to happen with the small group of Tea Party members and very radical right Republicans having seemingly a stranglehold on the whole rest of the House.
Well, it's up to the Democrats and liberal and thoughtful moderate Republicans to get rid of these guys, frankly— and get us a Congress that can finally go back to work and do the kinds of things this country needs.
Was the filibuster vote a mistake in terms of trying to get
to— I've been against the filibuster for years, Jim. I think the notion that a small, relatively small minority can tie the place up. I mean, look, when I was governor, you got elected, you appointed your cabinet. You didn't need confirmation from anybody. Your cabinet went to work. And whether or not you succeeded had a lot to do with whether or not they succeeded. And look, if you pick somebody lousy, then you had to take the heat. But how many, 236 Obama appointees are sitting there? I mean, this is a disgrace. And frankly, I think the filibuster should have been eliminated a long time ago, and especially when it comes to the appointments of the president. Look, I wasn't a big fan of Ronald Reagan's. But if the people of the United States elect Ronald Reagan, he's entitled to have his team.
I'm with you. You know, Governor, when I look at you, and if we didn't hear, his 80th birthday was on November 3rd. You know, you seem to be one of the most well-adjusted souls. I'm serious. who has been in high places. How do you, it's what, 25 years since he ran for the, I interviewed Al Gore and Tipper Gore about a year or two. They did a photograph book after he lost that election. And I said, so do you get wake up every day? Do you think about this every single day? And they both said, oh, no, we never think about it at all. No. Do you say to yourself, I was this close, not only for you personally, but talk about how history would have changed. You don't, how did this affect you?
Not now, but I mean, that first year wasn't fun.
What was that like? What do you mean?
Well, I mean, I had blown an election that I think had I done it better.
You were up 17 points in Atlanta, weren't you?
Well, not really.
Well, whatever. You were up.
But I was up. Okay. And it was a winnable election, and I blew it. But after a while, I mean, furthermore, I had to come back here at a time when the country was going into another recession. And that wasn't a fun last 2 years of mine in the governor's office. So,
even though you were helped by a fabulous tax reformer, if I remember correctly, he really was one of the finest young advocates I've ever come across.
It's Jim Browdy, in case
you don't
know.
Right. That's who it was. Yes. I'm sorry.
Exactly. In any event, you know, you got to move on. And I've been at Northeastern now since June of 1991. The place is terrific. I can't say enough for it. I love teaching these young people. And
What do you teach?
I teach public policy. I teach public management. I teach health policy. I teach state and local government. But what I'm really trying to do is to help train the next generation of public leaders. And let me tell you, these kids are wonderful, Jim, both here and on the West Coast, where I teach at UCLA in the wintertime. I can't say enough of these. I love the co-op program. I don't know why more colleges and universities don't adopt
it.
It's brilliant.
Northeastern had more applicants for admission to the freshman class last year than any non-public university in the United States of America. Part of it's Boston, but a lot of it's co-op. And I'm teaching, in fact, I just taught them this morning, a class of mostly juniors and seniors, some middlers, as we call them, public policy and administration. It's a joy to walk into that classroom and teach and work with these kids. They're wonderful. And I do the best I can to help them with their co-ops and open up doors for them. So, you know, in addition to being very active generally on the public side. And so teaching for me has been a wonderful kind of second career.
Now, do you follow the Mediterranean diet being Greek, Michael Dukakis?
As much as I can.
I figured you look terrific. How many grandchildren do you have?
I have 8, and tragically, in some ways, we now have 12 because the sister of our daughter-in-law was killed in an automobile accident this summer, and she had 4 kids, so our son and daughter-in-law have now essentially—
taken those kids in. 4, was that right?
Have now custody of these 4, and they're in Newton. And by the way, I cannot, Marjorie, say enough for Newton, the school system, and the people of that community. They have been just wonderful to these kids.
That's terrific.
Who watched their mother die in an automobile accident. So, you know, we now got we got 12 where we had 8. But, you know, and they're a great joy. I mean, I don't have to tell you. We've got, you know, 3 great kids and 8 grandkids of our own, and now these 4 additional kids. And what can I tell you? Life is good.
Life is good, and you told me 80 is the new 20.
Yeah.
So there
is married to a great woman who continues to be the best-looking Medicare recipient in the United States of America.
50th anniversary in Greece. Is that not what you told me? Was that not what you went for?
Unfortunately, I picked up this terrible germ that got into my left eye, and I almost lost my eye, which is why I'm wearing these spectacles. So,
did you tell me that was the first time you ever been in a hospital in your whole life? Is that what you said to me?
Overnight, yeah.
That is hard to believe.
Yeah. And well, a great team of Greek doctors and nurses saved this life, saved this eye of mine.
Single payer?
Free.
Free.
Yeah. I asked the doctor at a community hospital to examine me for the first time. He said, look, you've got an ulcerated cornea. You've got to get to Athens in a hurry and get that treated. I said, what do I owe you? He said, oh, no, this is part of the national health system. I said, don't you want to see my insurance card? He said, no, this is free. Little old Greece, you know, getting banged around. And by the way, these folks knew what they were doing.
That was former Governor Mike Dukakis. He was also the 1988 Democratic presidential nominee. He joined us earlier this year. When we come back, we're going to continue bringing you some of our best open mic moments with Nancy Kane. She joins us to talk about how animal liberation could be the social movement of the 21st century. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we're replaying some of the best open mic moments we've had over the past year. Last month, Harvard historian Nancy Kane joined us to talk about the new frontier of animal liberation. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us in Studio 3, as she does every Tuesday for open mic, is Nancy Kane. Nancy is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, even though we won't be saying that much longer, is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy, it's great to see you.
Always great to be here.
Hi, Nancy. So we're going to talk about this great piece from the Times Magazine. The headline was, Should a Chimp Be Able to Sue Its Owner? And it's all about, or most of it is about, this attorney named Stephen Wise. So tell us about Stephen Wise, please, Nancy.
So Mr. Wise is a very interesting lawyer. And he has been systematically for more than 15 years trying to build a field of law that sits in the broader pasture of animal welfare, but is really much more focused literally on animal rights, and particularly on rights that legally, you know, traditionally by precedent, by practice in the legal system, have been oriented around the concept of personhood. So he is trying to literally eke out a space in the courtrooms of this country around how can you file you know, in some sense, you know, legal suit, legal action on behalf of animals that whose rights are being, by his and by many, many people's measures, by measures that we would apply to human beings, are being infringed. And not he's not arguing that all rights that obtain to humans obtain to animals. He's arguing that certain rights, all of us would agree, right? All of us would agree, forgive that little interrogative, are obligations of decency towards sentient beings, including or focused on intelligent animals. So he has chosen very strategically, he's a very strategic thinker in this very interesting article called Should a Chimp Be Able to Sue Its Owner? In last week's Times Magazine by Charles Siebert is a reporter. He's arguing that, you know, they were focused on very, very intelligent animals. So this is – he literally filed suit on behalf of a chimp that was held in a
dungeon.
Tommy was the name of the chimp. Many people would say cruel circumstances. And he filed suit on habeas corpus. He chose that kind of suit to file very specifically because the law, common law, this is not federal law. It's harder to do all kinds of things in federal law because the standards of proof are higher and the standards of bringing a suit to trial or to a judge are higher. So he's choosing to focus on issues around habeas corpus, filing on behalf of a certain person as a right to bring trial. And he filed suit on behalf of Tommy, that Tommy was being kept in circumstances that were, you know, were basic that were in basic disregard of his rights to a certain kind of life. In this case, captivity.
I want to underline something you said. The lawsuit was filed in conjunction with a group called the Non-Human Rights Project. They filed a bunch of lawsuits in New York State, which they thought was the most fertile jurisdiction for this because they did an analysis of judges, that sort of thing. The most important point, I think, is the one you mentioned up front, Nancy. The reason they picked chimps is because, as the piece says, they have higher order cognitive abilities. They have a sense of past and future. Essentially, they're the most like humans, and that's how they decided to pick them. Ultimately, they want to deal with dolphins and orcas
and
others.
Right.
But essentially, their contention is that this is not an issue of animal protection, which is on the move in this country. In fact, it was a high-profile bill just filed at the State House to expand protection of animals in the wake of the puppy dough thing out of Quincy a couple of months ago, another horrible incident a few weeks ago. But essentially, that they have rights. They have rights that humans have. How do you find that as a proposition?
Well, I find it, you know, manifestly obvious in some sense. I went back to my copy of Darwin, which I haven't really opened. Not Origin of Species, his most famous work, a work that followed that's equally important called Descent of Man, which is about the relationship between man and mammals and man and all kinds of animals. And he has a whole chapter. I actually went back literally and read it. I see my handwriting from like 25 years ago. Oh, when I was a graduate student.
And
my handwriting, I noticed, is different.
Great.
But literally, let me just read you one sentence. This is from the second page of chapter 3, The Comparison of the Mental Powers of Man and the Lower Animals. My object in this chapter, remember, he's a scientist. He's not a member of PETA, right? He had dogs, but, you know, this is a man of science who took a long, sweet time about getting Origin of Species out, but never lacked, right, for the will to collect the needed evidence based on the scientific record. So my object in this chapter is to show that there's no fundamental difference between man and the higher mammals in their mental faculties. So I actually read this entire chapter last night. It's in tiny little print in my, like, you know, modern library edition of like 1938. and he goes through all these different aspects of what we think of as mental faculties: reason, curiosity, memory, imagination, ability to problem solve. He literally goes through them page by page, where each of those faculties is in italics. He stops at belief in God, but he doesn't stop at sense of beauty, and he has all these interesting examples from Arctic dogs that figure out on thin ice that they don't actually want to travel in a straight line. If they're pulling a sled, they want to fan out because they're less likely to pull the sled, break the ice.
Really?
To these amazing stories that he's observed. Remember, this is not a typical animal lover. There's a scientist who wants to make his name in a brand new field,
right?
And is looking for evidence that substantiates a theory about the origin of man. And so he has all these examples to, you know, animals that can completely solve these complicated problems. And so I think it's very, very hard for anyone that, you know, is awake to think that animals, you know, have no relationship to man, and that there's this dark line between human beings and, say, chimpanzees, or chimpanzees and dolphins, or dolphins and elephants. Let's be reasonable. These are creatures with great capacity. And last comment. Whether we want to go as far as saying these creatures have rights that we need to line up or delineate or somehow, you know, carve a subset out of a larger, much larger list of rights for human beings, you know, whether we want to do that or not, I think the really interesting question is this question, and it's not mine. It goes all the way back to Jeremy Bentham, right, pre-Darwin, the philosopher and moralist who wrote about all kinds of moral issues. And he said the question is less do they think, right, or what is their mental capacity? Because it's entirely possible to argue, as many, many people have, that a child that is born with severe – or a human being that has severely constrained, right, mental capacity can have less intelligence on lots of different measures than a highly functioning chimp. So again, we're in slippery slope here. But Bentham argues the question isn't what are their mental faculties? The question isn't are they like us? The question around these kind of issues is can they suffer? So I think that, and I'm not, you know, I'm not the first person to look at that question. That's an important question.
But they can all suffer.
So
the place where you lose me on this, I think, and where Stephen Wise loses me, I completely agree with 99% of what you said. Those animals which can suffer, obviously, are entitled to some protection. But this is this guy Richard Epstein, who's quoted right. in the story from NYU. Who has
a legal scholar
has utter contempt for Stephen Wise. It's pretty clear.
He didn't have to say, "I don't think he's a great intellect."
He says, "Right."
Did he really have to go
there?
He's
a man of tremendous.
Even though that was exactly that.
He says, "My attitude is this, which is exactly where I am. I mean, I agree with all the things you said about suffering, and they are animals just like we are animals. My attitude," says Richard Epstein, "is there are two ways to think about this. He thinks of it as rights, just meaning Stephen Wise.
That's his right. That's
I think
his chosen
about it
territory.
As protection.
Right.
And in light of the fact, and the reason I think about it as protection too, is let's assume this chimp were to win its suit. And by the way, they lost all their litigation in the lower court. They knew they were. They wanted to establish a record, and then they're going to the appellate courts in New York State. But even if they were to win on behalf of Tommy the chimp doesn't go free. The chimp gets humane protection, right. humane treatment. So isn't that the issue, protection, not rights? Why are you having a bird over there?
Because I think obviously, I mean, many of us have seen the Blackfish CNN documentary about the orcas that are at SeaWorld, which are highly...
Very controversial film.
Very controversial film, that's right. But what they argued in that film is that these orcas are very social animals. They're taken away from their families. They're living these lives of misery, and that's why they go around killing trainers when their frustration builds up. No one is the animal protection laws would not help the orcas.
So expand the animal protection laws.
Well, I don't know.
Just like
maybe,
it's being proposed on Beacon Hill.
Let's take a step back from rights. Let's look at Stephen Wise as someone who's decided here's some landscape that may be fertile that I can plow and plant on in the interest, call it protection, call it rights. I'm not sure the language actually matters so much. And I can imagine Richard Posner getting all anxious about whether this becomes part of the legal landscape, because that's going to be it's going to create a whole class of lawyers and stuff in the courts and whatnot. But the issue is still about how do we, as a society, and we're a society that lags behind Europe and some other parts of the world in thinking about this, ahead of China, behind a lot of Europe
Russians.
In thinking about, you know, what is serious, viable, you know, effective, and also practicable protection.
I agree.
Okay, so I think, you know, so one thing that happens is if Stephen Wise gets traction and his human non-human rights project begins to gather steam, as it clearly is, for all kinds of reasons that aren't really less about rights and more about our increasing knowledge and awareness of what our living, or the way we live, what that means for a bunch of creatures. So if he gets traction, then, you know, the end result is less that I think we're going to have a whole lot of lawyers and a new field of law. We will have it, but that we will get people that are serious about enforcing the protection laws.
Well, I agree, but I think you're mischaracterizing Stephen Wise. I don't know him. I'm just reading
no,
about
nor
him.
Do I.
My
nor do
sense
I.
is he's not about compromise. I think you're speaking practically. That may be the consequence, and I think if that's the case, that's a good thing.
Yep.
But my sense is he's a take-no-prisoners kind of thing. By the way, just as one aside, Marjorie and I both remarked on this, and this does not have anything to do with what you brought to us today, Nancy Kane. David Frank from Mass Lawyers Weekly, whenever he's here, we get in a big, not a fight with him, a discussion about why can't judges talk about cases in Massachusetts, which would be far better for public understanding and whatever. There is a beautiful interview here with this Judge Size, S-I-S-E, where while he
Joseph
ruled
Size.
While he ruled against Stephen Wise, he explains in a way that the public can understand why he decided to rule as he did, which completely, in my view, helps public understanding of
Absolutely.
What's going on in the courtroom.
Absolutely.
But in Massachusetts, they're mute, which is a whole topic for a another day.
Absolutely. So, you know, I was sitting in the green room before I walked into the studio thinking about why, in the broad sweep of history, are we suddenly, as a world, as a global village, starting to think about these kind of issues with new intensity and new edge, right? Why is there a PETA? Right. A P.S., by the way, just as a historical footnote, you know, we may think, many of us and many of our listeners may think that Stephen Wise is, you know, a hard-nosed, take-no-prisoners, slightly wacky zealot. They said the same thing about Mary Wollstonecraft in 1792 when she was arguing for the rights of women. Right. They said the same thing about Susan B. Anthony. They said the same thing about Martin Luther King. They said the same thing about the early gay rights activists. So remember, the way a lot of people, including Posner, think about someone like Stephen Wise is very similar to other kinds of activist pushing.
Do you think we're going to look back on Stephen Wise in 50 years and say he was the Martin Luther King of his generation?
Close down the
zoos. I do not. But I think that, well, we already are saying that about Peter Singer, who's a much bigger figure in animal liberation than Wise probably will ever be. And he is now considered an absolutely Animal Liberation 1975, fascinating book. Peter Singer, a philosopher at Princeton, still, right? He's written all kinds of stuff on all kinds of moral issues.
You know what I learned in this endless piece in the New York Times magazine, which, and I meant that for emphasis, it is great, but it is long, is while the issue now is essentially can an animal with high cognitive abilities be a plaintiff, essentially, so that it has a certain set of rights?
And what do they wear?
What I didn't know is starting in the Middle Ages up until the early 1900s, in civilized society, animals were defendants in criminal cases all over the case, charged with crimes. A pig was sentenced to death. Where was it? In the UK in 1906, because it participated in some crime, and the judge said that were not for the pig, the person wouldn't be dead. I mean, were you surprised? Did you know that?
So again, let me go back to my original, like, large kind of picture historian's observation. So I was thinking, so yes, I mean, I was surprised by that, but, you know, I mean, the common law emerged, right, from people trying to, you know, settle and find solutions to all kinds of issues of living in common together, including the critical importance of animals in everyday life in a way many of us, with the exception of our pets, and that's not a small exception, we can't have any access to anymore because we don't live in the land and we don't live with animals and we don't kill our own meat.
Right.
So I was thinking, why is it suddenly that suddenly there's this kind of, we can feel it growing, this momentum around even things like factory farming, right, which is the greatest perpetrator of unspeakable cruelty every single day, for every single minute.
I'm dying to hear the answer.
So here's
it.
So I was thinking, so why is it? So I think it's because until the mid-19th century, maybe a little bit later, almost all people all over the world lived with animals. They ate their own, they killed their own meat, whether it was pigs or fish or beef or sheep or goats. They killed it, right? They lived with it. Until 1700, in lots of parts of Europe, animals actually literally lived in the house for warmth in a section of a big grass or log hut. So it's only been in the last 120 years that people have separated themselves from animals. And that the scale of production and resource needs have grown so large that we are impinging, right? We talked about the sixth extinction mm-hmm. last week. They are pushing and crowding into wildlife. We never had medical testing and medical research on animals until the 20th century. This is a brand new, speaking from a historian standpoint, issue. And like women, right, coming to public consciousness and their demand for rights, it calls for a conversation and some action.
Okay, well, so let's predict. You think about your historian. Where are we 50 years from now on this whole issue?
When we have you back on Boston Public Radio in 50 years, yeah, Marjorie asks you a question. Yeah, what are you going to say?
After four facelifts, right, and some really zippy go-go boots, because I intend to be a very, very zippy, 90-year-old.
In that get-up, what are you going to say?
When you're back here at 90, what
was it happen? Do you remember back in the, at the early 21st century when we actually, cut chickens' feet off and put them in tiny little boxes and tried to fatten them as fast as we could and, clip their beaks so they wouldn't peck and kept animals, cows confined in, 4x6 boxes for all their life. Do you remember that? Do you remember that's actually how we used to do it? Can you imagine?
So we have 30 seconds. Your point is we've come so far, so fast. Is that where you're going with this, that it's not unreasonable to think that we get to the point somewhere near where Stephen Wise wants in the next 50 years?
I don't know if it's Stephen Wise. I think it's just where we all actually wake up and look at the real costs. We may all still eat meat, but we look at the real costs of some of the everyday choices we make all over the world 24/7, or as my personal trainer used to like to say, all day, every day.
Well, I hope you're right.
You said it beautifully, too.
I always feel
too.
Bad when you
great.
Go to the zoos and you see the animals in the zoo and they always look so depressed.
Well, very few people are defending that, by the way.
Okay.
Can they suffer? Animal Liberation 1975. Don't pass go. Don't collect $200. Take a look at it.
Nancy Kane is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. When we come back, we'll continue to bring you some of our best open mic moments. Up next is former ambassador to the Vatican and mayor of Boston, Ray Flynn. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Today we're rebroadcasting some of our best open mic conversations. With only a couple of weeks to go before Boston elected its first new mayor in 20 years, former Boston Mayor Ray Flynn joined us to talk Boston politics, Boston sports, and Pope Francis. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Joining us in Studio 3 for a special edition of Open Mic is the former mayor of Boston and the former U.S. ambassador to the Vatican. That would be Ray Flynn. Mayor, Ambassador Ray, nice to see you.
It's great to see you, Jim and Marjorie.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming in, Mayor Flynn.
Sure.
I'm dying to know. You know a lot about politicking. So here we've got these two guys running for mayor. The race is 2 weeks from tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the Red Sox in the World Series.
Yeah.
What do you do when you want to win? You want to get out there, reach as many people as possible. How do you handle the Red Sox issue?
Well, I don't know if you really can, except that you have to be available if anybody asks you your position. How do you feel? Maybe get down to the Erie Pub and watch the ball game down at the Erie Pub, and
Didn't you have a drink with Bill Weld there once?
With Bill Clinton, that's what.
Oh,
made
Bill Clinton, that's
made
right.
Made the place famous. Brought Bill Clinton in there and Ronald Reagan.
Ronald
went
Reagan,
in there.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's you do the things that people do. You don't try to fight it. You don't try to create something that you can't make.
Did you go outside Fenway?
No, I wouldn't do that.
You wouldn't?
No.
You try to get tickets and wave to people from the stands?
No. No, I wouldn't. I just, if you go overboard on it, you know, people see it as a shrill and they know that it's insincere and it's just grandstanding, no pun intended. But just do whatever is natural. That's the secret of politics anyway. I mean, all these spin doctors and all these professional consultants and so forth, they get carried away listening to these people. And, you know, you have the Red Sox. I remember, was it 75 with Joe Timothy and Kevin White? Mm-hmm. I mean, this changed the whole complexion of the election for mayor of Boston. Joe Timothy was going to win that election. And the next thing that happened, the euphoria and the pride in Boston and the Red Sox in the World Series and everybody rallying behind the, you know, the city, the pride, the banner of Boston. And they swept Kevin White back into office. So, but there is no incumbent this time.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a toss ball.
You know, I don't know if anybody's ever asked this, but it just occurred to me. I was asking about Providence College, your alma mater, where you were a great basketball player. We had a United States Senator, Scott Brown, a pretty good basketball player at Tufts. You ever gone one-on-one with the – now, he's a little bit younger than you are, Ray Flynn.
Oh,
but,
come on, Marjorie. You're asking that kind of question. Scott Brown, I beat him about 95 to nothing. Please.
Excuse me, it's downtown just Scotty Brown
checking.
To you, Ray Flynn.
So, wow.
Ray Flynn, you were talked about a lot in this most recent election cycle. 30 years ago, the final is you against Mel King. You both got to get about 48,000 votes to make you to get you into the final. At that time, Boston was roughly one-third minority. We're a majority minority city, and none of the people of color, including some pretty serious candidates, Barros, Arroyo, Gullah Ritchie, made it to the final. Were you surprised by that?
You know, Jim, the city has changed so dramatically. You know, I can almost predict, you know, what's happening. Just taking my grandson for a walk down Broadway and walking over the bridge to Copley Place and walking around the South End. The old timers, people who are established in the city, you know, they grew up and they all vote. The people that have been relatively newcomers, the so-called young professionals, don't vote. And I hate to say that, but that's the way it is. And that's the reason why you're seeing, what, 200,000 people, 70% of the people, 60% of the black community came out to vote in that Mel King election with me. 60%. You only got about 25% the last time, and you had four good candidates on the ballot, four minority good candidates. So, you know, it's a different situation. You get down the South End in that period of time in 83, everybody was standing in line waiting to go to the polls, the black people, the minority people. But now I drove by there. I walked by there. I didn't see anybody. I didn't see hardly anybody.
If there had been one, a big controversy, as I'm sure you're aware, were these meetings that were had that allegedly were authorized by none of the candidates early on, where there was discussion by some activists about whether or not there should be an urging of a candidate of color or two to drop out to consolidate support for another. Had there been one serious candidate of color rather than three, would they be in the final?
You know, Jim, 20 years is a long time to be in the office of mayor without having any kind of political power, the minority community, the black community. Sure, they have locally elected officials, but they didn't see themselves as being taking over City Hall and having that real power. And it takes time. You know, there's been a lot of great politicians, including a lot of great black leaders over time, there's Barros and Gullah Ritchie and, you know, all these young fellas.
Wayana Presley is the top vote getter
yeah.
in the city
but
council.
But they see that they haven't broadened their base.
And do you think that's the mindset 20, of the voter
yeah,
in communities of
well,
color?
How do they know? How do they know these people? What have they done? What's their power? What is their platform? What do they represent? I mean, sure, they know them. They're their familiar name. But, you know, hey, look, you know, when I ran for mayor of Boston, everybody knew who I was. I put the lights up at the basketball field court for the kids. Mel King was down there. He put up the tennis courts for the kids down in the South End. I mean, we were all doing these things for years and years and years. And so as a result of that, we had built up a reputation and a constituency that was well-known even outside of our immediate neighborhood.
Well, you're also jogging through the neighborhoods quite a bit as well, Mayor Flynn.
Yeah.
Do you think it matters that much, though? 2000, there's been a lot of gnashing of teeth over this, the whole idea that in a minority-majority city, we didn't get a person of color in the finals. On the other hand, it's a much different city race-wise than it was in 1993 when you ran. There was still the busing residue. It was a lot of real tension between the black community and the white community. I think it's better now, clearly, isn't
it? Well, you haven't really built – the press really hasn't built up a strong black candidate, a minority candidate in Boston. You know, what is the accomplishment? What if they saw that they were well-known, they were, accomplished, able to get things done, have got things done – people would feel an obligation to go out and vote.
Right.
But they don't know who these candidates are. They know their name, but they don't know their – you know, they haven't really got that notoriety. And it's not their fault. They've done a lot of good things. I would – you know, look, here's the best way to describe it, Marjorie. And I had this conversation with Kevin White. When we showed up at City Hall every single day, there were 17 reporters covering City Hall.
That's true.
17 reporters. Right now, there's one reporter covering Boston City Hall. I mean, we had to give the reporter something to chew on for the day, a story. If we didn't, the reporters, 17 of them, would go running around looking under every rug to see what's going on. So, you know, now you walk into City Hall, you don't have that problem anymore. It's you put out a press release. You know, nobody covers the neighborhoods anymore.
No, that's true. That's the tragedy of the media changing so much.
You can't blame the media. You can't blame the reporters. It's just the economics of it.
Yep.
And it's a changing time. Now, most of the people that I know who voted in the 83 campaign, they don't cling to the internet to find out what's going on or the various Facebook pages or whatever. You know, they don't do that. You know, if it's not in the Herald, it's not in the Globe, it didn't happen.
On Boston Public Radio, we know you meant to include that. Now, Ray Flynn,
I purposely didn't mention Boston Public Radio, frankly. This is the first time I've ever been here.
Is that true?
Really?
Yeah, this is the very first time I've ever been here.
It's pretty snazzy,
isn't it?
There's
something more to that. Finish the
thought. No, that's it.
That's it?
Yeah.
Are you're not making a disparaging remark about having been here in the past?
No, I'm just saying how things have changed. I'm glad you're having this kind of a program.
I was against it, Ray Flynn. I want you to know, but I was voted down. Hey, Ray.
So the Catholics had to stay together, Ray Flynn.
Mayor Flynn, we're going to get to that issue in a second, actually. What do you think of the final field? What do you think? I assume you know Walsh and Connolly.
I know both of them very, very well.
What do you think
of
the field?
I think it's a good field. I think it's a very good field. I think they both bring a very different dimension to the campaign. I think it's a little bit unstated. I think it's over-exaggerated, the depiction of both of them. You know, John Connolly being a prestige candidate or whatever.
Son of privilege.
Yeah, son of privilege. That's a lot of baloney. I mean, I know Michael Connolly, the father. I worked
Former
with Michael
Connolly.
Yeah. Well, I knew him at the state rep. He was a state rep. A wonderful man, hardworking guy. I mean, really hardworking family. You know, because he went to Harvard, he's a son of privilege. I can show you kids from South Boston, D Street Project, that went to Harvard, played sports, and you know they're working for the common good now. I mean, these aren't privileged kids; these are hardworking kids. And the same way with Marty Walsh, you know, a pawn of the unions, not at all.
You're comfortable with either of these guys? Being the next mayor of Boston?
I think so.
Who are you voting for?
Well, you asked me that before.
I figured I'd try again.
Yeah, well, keep trying.
Hey, speaking of mayor, there was somebody in between you and these guys. You've never been, I don't want to put words in your mouth, you can correct me, you've never warmed to the mayoralty of Tom Menino. Is that a fair statement?
Well, it's nothing personal. It's just that, you know, I've never been asked to play any kind of role. And, you know, you don't beat the door down at City Hall to be...
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I mean, I can't answer that question. I wasn't a great friend of Kevin White either, but I always, I picked up the phone and called Kevin White, took him for a ride out to Doyle's, had lunch out to Doyle's, took him a ride around the city, got his opinion about different things. Bob Beale used to take Kevin White and Catherine White and Kathy and myself out for lunch.
Kathy, your wife, yeah. Of course, was just here. Yeah. It was nice to see her.
And so, you know, there was a, you know, it wasn't a friendly personal thing, but it was what it was a professional relationship that I saw, you know, that I could benefit from his experiences. Now, that's the way I felt. Tommy Menino thinks differently. That's fine. I have no problem with that. That's his choice. I will say that if he had asked me to play some kind of role, not any kind of position in City Hall, but just in terms of advice or, you know, about something or other, you know, I think I could have been helpful, but that didn't happen. So let's move on from there.
Let's move on from there to a topic that I know will bring smiles to both your face and Marjorie Egan's face. Do you want to start it, Marjorie?
Well, yeah. A lot of us are very excited about the new Pope Francis talking about poverty issues, talking about not obsessing over the sex issues, you know, gay marriage and stuff like that. But I wonder what you think of him, number one. And I wonder if you think, I mean, there are very few Catholics who are still going to church anymore, as you know, Ray Flynn, if this is going to matter in terms of getting Catholics back in the pews.
Kathy and I were in the room there. I don't know if you call it the green room there.
Yes.
And this is a good segue to your question. The reason why the previous conversation you had about giving, helping people, where did I get that? Why do people do call it? You know, what do you think? They come out of Mars somewhere? A lot of these people did this because this is what they believe. This is their core values as people. What did I grow up as a kid? Social and economic justice. It has nothing to do with the Democratic Party or the Republican Party or liberal or conservative. I was taught this as a little boy. Faith, hope, charity.
Yeah.
You know, look, when I was playing semi-pro baseball, my manager was Knocko McCormick.
Knocko
McCormick was John W. McCormick's brother.
Really?
The Speaker of the United States House of Representatives. I didn't drive. I didn't have a car. Knocko would pick me up. I'd work down at the waterfront as a dock worker. Knocko would pick me up around 5 o'clock, and we'd go over to Dorchester Town Field to play baseball. Now, Knocko never, ever walked by a person down on their luck. Down on their luck. Notice what I said. That's what my mother taught me. These are all people down on their luck. And he'd always have a dollar for them or 50 cents or whatever it was. Well, I watched this. I saw this. And one time, shortly thereafter, I was at Fenway Park, and I had just enough money to get home on the public transportation, MBTA. I'm going by person down on their luck. I gave the guy my last dollar, okay? I walked home like 12 o'clock at night. Why do I do that? Was I looking for attention? Was I making a political statement? No. What I was doing is I was following the example of what my mother, what my faith, what my neighbors did for their neighbors, people they didn't even know. So it's, you know, I think you see what happens is that people feel strongly about helping people down on their luck. It has about their core values and their core principles.
You know Pope Francis prior to his ascendancy. Yeah. Tell us about him as a person.
Well, that's the question I should have answered when Marjorie asked directly. It's about humility. I was up in New Hampshire last night speaking to a group, and then the night before I was talking to Little Sisters of the Poor in Providence. And I was talking about Pope Francis, and that's what it's all about. This man is a genuinely humble man. You know, I can give you 10 or 15 good examples, if we had time, of where I personally saw him do things. When I was during the death of John Paul II, the passing of John Paul II, I was working for NBC. And I was preparing for Tim Russett and I were walking down the street. We're going to do Meet the Press. And we saw Pope Francis. He was Cardinal Archbishop of Buenos Aires at the time. And we talked to him for 4, 5, 10 minutes maybe. And what we heard from him was that, you know, it's all about he didn't have a car. He walked to his destination. He'd get on the bus, took the bus to the place where he was staying. He didn't stay in the palatial apostolic palace. He had like this little hotel a distance from the from St. Peter's Square. We saw that, and we saw him get one of those little pani sandwiches. They were about $2 or maybe about 75 cents for a cappuccino. This is what he was having for dinner after this very important ceremony at the Vatican.
If he had, if the cardinals had known that Pope Francis would say and do what he did in his first months of holding the papacy, would he have been elected by them?
That's a good question. I'm glad you asked that question because I think the answer to that is yes. They probably would think and pause for a minute and say, what is he trying to do? What's the statement that he's making? But then when they reflect on it, like I do, I reflect on it. February 11th, when Benedict announced that he was stepping down, I knew, and I said this publicly, and I wrote a book about it. I said the next pope will be somebody from America. Now, I included Latin Central America because that's the church. That's where the church is growing. And that's where the heart of the church is. The heart of the church is in Latin and Central America. And it's
in Africa. Right?
Yeah. In Africa. I mean, I went to Nigeria, and people were standing outside, not only standing outside the church, but they were like three blocks away waiting for, you know, participating in the Mass. I mean, it's alive. It's really the church. We see it here. And we see the downside, I guess, of it. But over there, it is really much alive, and it's all about the things. God bless you. And it's all about the things that we hold dear as old time Catholics, and that is the values of helping people, treating people with dignity and respect. Jim, what is the second commandment? The second commandment is we learn as little kids: help thy neighbor and love thy neighbor as you love yourself. If you stay with that, you can't go very wrong. And you stay with that in politics, you're going to do well.
So knowing you as I do, did you walk here from South Boston?
No. I'll tell you, we get up at – Kathy and I get up at 5 o'clock. We're up in Manchester, New Hampshire. We drove down back to Boston just to be on your show.
Good.
So we wouldn't be late.
Ray Flynn, one more question for me about the Pope. So is it going to matter? Is it going to bring back those – they're always advertising, bring back the lapsed Catholics, bring back the lapsed Catholics. You think it's going to make any difference?
Yeah, I do. I really do. I'm already seeing it. There's going to be a Gate of Heaven, my parish church, is celebrating its 150th anniversary on Sunday. Hope everybody goes. 12 o'clock Mass, Cardinal O'Malley's going to celebrate it, and I'm the speaker at the
Great.
Mass. Well, they're expecting about 700 or 800 people at the Mass on Sunday. Now, I know a number of these people. They're all my neighbors. This is the first time some of them have come back to the church in a good number of years, and they feel good about themselves, and they feel good about the parish, they feel good about the church, and I think Pope Francis has a lot to do with it. It's not about the palatial living quarters of the Apostolic Palace. It's not about riding around in the Pope Mobile and all that. Hey, look, I'm not critical of that. You know, I grew up with that, okay? But I'm just saying this Francis is taking us to another place. And you know what it is?
What?
It's a place where I feel very comfortable.
That was former Boston Mayor and Ambassador to the Vatican, Ray Flynn. When we come back, Alex Beam joins us. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we're playing some of our best open mic moments. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us as he does every Thursday for open mic is Alex Beam. And normally at this time, Marjorie and I marvel at how appropriate it is that he's named Alex Beam. But here's the bad news. Our high school intern who writes those obsequious hyperbolic tributes is on vacation. So instead, we're letting Alex's writing speak for itself.
The leading citizens of southwestern Illinois could have imprisoned Joseph Smith. They could have chased him back across the Mississippi and delivered him to his old enemies in Missouri. Instead, they killed him. Why? That is the story of this book.
And that book would be American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church by Alex Beam, out in bookstores now with unbelievably spectacular reviews. Congratulations,
yeah.
Alex.
Chicago Tribune, LA Times. Of course, all waiting with bated breath for the Boston Globe to weigh in, exactly. As well as the New York Times. Do you get any advance notice of when these reviews will be coming, Alex Beam?
No is the short answer. The Wall Street Journal reviewed a couple of days ago, which was agonizing because it has a paywall. I couldn't – anyway.
Wait a minute. Don't tell me you didn't look at the review in the Wall Street Journal.
You had to spend $4 to read it.
Indeed, it did cost $4.
Did you pay it?
No, absolutely not. What are you, nuts?
I read it to him.
Yeah.
You have to run to his neighbor's house out there. Would you live in Wellesley? A lot of people get in the Wall Street Journal out there. You could run to next door to the neighbors and grab the paper.
Alex, how long did you take to write this thing before you tell us what it's about?
Two years.
Do you?
That's
when you're
not
writing,
bad at all.
Is there anxiety? I'm serious about this. Every time we have an author who's done a major work, and this is a major work, do you, as you're getting to the end, say, what if I spend 2 years of my life and people think this is poorly written, poorly researched? How much anxiety is there from the time you finish the thing till you start reading what the alleged experts have to say about it?
Well, I think the honest answer is only a modest amount of anxiety. I mean, I and my friends who are writers, I can't imagine undertaking a project that – I mean, let's rephrase that. I've been lucky enough to undertake projects that were really fun for me to do, that were really consuming and interesting. And so there, the calculus – you have to tell to yourself is the book may fail. It's just a totally real possibility for any man or woman, the book may fail, but am I okay with how I spent these last 2 years? And if you can't answer that question yes, you're doing the wrong thing, absolutely. And to not answer a question that you didn't ask.
What is it?
The first time I could kind of breathe easily is like, you know, there's a moment when like, your wife, your cousin, your mom, her sister-in-law. There's a point at which, you know, somebody in the real world has got to read the book and pass judgment on it. And indeed, in publishing, there are things called pre-publication reviews. They're not written by your cousin. They're not written by your publicist. They're not written by your friend. They're written by some underpaid person. And, I got great pre-publication reviews. And second of all, Publishers Weekly, which is a really serious publication and really works hard, you know, like the book. So that was kind of encouraging.
Tell us a story.
Come on, Alex. You know when something's good. You've been writing a column for a long time. You have a pretty good idea if it was good or not good, don't you?
Not with a book. How it's going to be received.
Well, I wouldn't know.
I don't mean to be a jerk, but you don't know how it's going to be
received. Okay. Well, it was received enormously well. So tell us this fascinating story, because I really didn't know much about the murder of the kind of creepy guy that started. Well, that's the way you portray him, as a creepy guy.
I don't believe I call him a creepy
You didn't call him that,
guy.
But you portrayed him that way. Tell us the story of the murder of the founder of the Mormon Church.
Well, Joseph Smith, yes.
Joseph Smith.
Who, for the record, was not a creepy guy.
He was not a creepy guy?
He was a prophet who spoke to God.
Okay.
And a true prophet for 5 million Americans. Joseph Smith was found himself and his 10,000 followers in southwestern Illinois on the banks of the Mississippi River. This was really their refuge of last resort. They'd been chased out of Ohio. They'd been chased out of Missouri. They were very, very successful missionaries. So that's why they had such a huge following in this oddly named town called Nauvoo. And to make my 280-page story short, they just frankly alienated everybody around them. This is the American frontier. And they alienated people for a variety of reasons. They voted in blocks, so they controlled all the politics of the county they were in and the counties around. That really got people angry. They were viewed as heretics. I mean, you have to be straight about that. The Book of Mormon, the notion that somebody had handed to him by an angel a third canonical Bible in a relatively religious land, meaning the United States of the 1830s and 40s, is just way beyond the pale. That's an insane heresy. If he had been in England, he probably would have been burned, frankly. Thirdly, the polygamy was – the word was out all across the nation – and I mean from which means from the East Coast to the Mississippi River. As you know, newspapers printed and reprinted each other's stuff. He was known as sort of old Mormon Joe with his seraglio, you know, that he had a harem. I mean, somehow, even though polygamy was secret, and the fact that he had taken dozens of wives.
I didn't know that. Dozens of wives?
Well, there's my favorite footnote in my book. I can't find it. I have an actual footnote saying historians disagree as to the number of wives Joseph Smith. And then yeah. I quote three really prominent Mormon historians. One says 36, one says 52. Anyway.
Forgive me for calling it creepy, but I found that creepy. I'm sorry.
It's in the Old Testament, of course. I mean, Solomon had 1,000 wives, I think. So, and he's one of the creators of the original Israel, I think. But
1,000?
I think it's in the Old Testament. Bears checking, perhaps. In any event, there's a chapter in my book called "Everybody Hates the Mormons." I mean, that's the situation they found themselves in 1844 in Illinois. Everybody hated them. They were also, I might add, economically, there's this word this guy called me out for. They were economically self-sufficient, although I can't be bothered to use the word autonomous or self-sufficient, so I describe them as economically autarkic. But in any case, Mormons even, you know, they would be the first, incredibly insular culture and religion, as they were also at that time. So they were economically totally divorced from the country around them. Mormons did business with Mormons. They helped out other Mormons, and they did not help out non-Mormons. So that's, if you were counting, that's basically four reasons why everybody hated the Mormons. Everybody hated Joseph Smith. They had some relatively dubious reason for getting him inside a jail in Carthage, Illinois. And once they got him inside the jail, as many predicted, they simply lynched him. Although in this case, of course, they filled him full of bullets.
And the alleged perps were cleared after trial, correct?
Well, it's even sort of funnier than that if you have an incredibly dark sense of humor. I mean, he was murdered in broad daylight, you know, with hundreds of witnesses. And the thugs that actually killed Joseph Smith immediately kind of, you know, as Mark Twain would say, let out for the territory. They crossed the Mississippi River and disappeared into Missouri, which is just a locus centris for Mormon haters. So they put 9 other people on trial, people who actually didn't kill Joseph Smith, but people just hated Mormons on principle. And there was this long, month-long trial, and they were all acquitted.
There was some, not to get too gruesome into the details here, but he fell from a second-floor window. What was that about when he was killed? He started on the second floor and wound up outside?
Yes. I mean, I've been to the Carthage jailhouse. And, I mean, for the men and women who are listening who might be Mormons, I mean, they probably know every second of this story. But the so-called, you know, the mob invaded his jail cell, started firing at him, and there's a window there on the second floor, and Joseph was the only one who tried to climb out the window, although he was shot both from the door of his own jail cell, but simultaneously he was also shot from the ground.
Oh.
So he tumbles, some would say lifeless. There's a huge dispute of whether he lost his life by the time he tumbled out of the... But the key thing is that before he tumbles out of the window, he says, Lord, is there no help for the widow's son, which is the Masonic call of distress. It's genuinely fascinating. He called out to the male Masons in the mob because a Mason cannot bear arms or harm another Mason. And a part of my book that is to be fair, a little bit complicated, but essential, was that Joseph Smith embraced Masonry, which, as you know, takes out ads on the radio right now, is very much alive in the United States. He embraced the ritual of Masonry in part to ingratiate himself with the kind of movers and shakers in Illinois. And it's incredible in a way that his last words were, Lord, have pity on, you know, have you no pity for the widow's son? But it's incredibly dramatic. I'm not a Mason. The Masons just kept shooting him. So that's how much they hated him.
And this is all pre-Utah for people who are saying, what is Illinois after? There was obviously pre-Brigham Young and pre-Utah. You know, I haven't read it yet. I've read all the reviews. And I have to say, it is clearly not, which I think you'd agree, it's not an Irenic book. Would you agree with that? Now, the reason I say
Irenic.
That, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Here's why I say this. I am reading one of the reviews a couple of days ago. This is in the Chicago Tribune that praises practically every word. However, in the middle, mirroring something that is occasionally said in the studio to Alex, I will read from the Chicago Tribune. Marjorie, while the prose is engaging, it does come with a quirk. Some of Beam's words, how do you say that word? Irenic?
Irenic.
Irenic, autarky, and they mention a few others, live outside the vocabulary of many readers. So you were true to yourself is the bottom line.
To be fair, he goes on to say, he says two things. He says, you can understand those words in their context in the book. And secondly, he says, thanks for the vocab lesson.
Yeah. Hey, Alex, you say at some point this guy said, I'm paraphrasing, he, Joseph Smith, I guess I may be forced to be president of the United States. Now, his perception, was that perception anywhere near the reality of his power and influence and
well,
that
just
sort
to put
of thing?
That in context, I mean, there was a presidential election in 1844. Joseph Smith was nationally known celebrity, and he chose to run for president. I think it was utterly delusional. No, there's nothing to back that up. I mean, he did make comments in Nauvoo, Illinois. He said, I wouldn't be surprised if I'm the next president of the United States, and even then thought he might get elected 4 years later. I happen to think that's part of a manic delusion.
So contrast him to Brigham Young that replaced him, and I think many people think of, you know, Brigham Young University, and Brigham Young is always associated with the Mormon Church and stuff. What's the difference?
Well, I mean, to hype my book, which naturally pains me somewhat, I mean, what's interesting—
Can I interrupt you to say, by the way, if you're going to hype a book, the fact that you do not understand that you have to say the title— I'm serious. Every book
American
interview,
Crucifixion.
You
it's
say
a great
in
title.
My book, The American Crucifixion. You have to try doing that now.
Say in my book, Better Living Through Yoga.
Go ahead, Alex. Yoga, I'm sorry. I'm just trying to help you out.
No, I understand that. Yeah, the book's called American Crucifixion. Anyway, I mean, I think one thing that's genuinely interesting about the book is that this is a genuine so-called hinge of history. It's a hinge of American history because it's only through the killing of Joseph Smith, that my favorite trite piece of writing from my own pen is that, you know, it's only because Joseph is killed that Brigham Young takes them in flatboats across the Mississippi River and, as I write, into the mainstream of American history. I mean, this is the galvanizing event. They realized they're going to kill us if we stay in the actual United States. So Brigham Young, who's, you know, incredibly dynamic leader, who's elected, so to speak. In fact, he is elected after Joseph is killed to be their new leader. He leads the Mormons westward to Utah, to the intermontane west, as I choose to call
another
it.
Another of the words, yes. That means between mountains. I looked that up.
Go right. Ahead. I mean, it's a truly incredible story. And Joseph Smith had this idea even before his death. He said, we've just got to go somewhere where nobody's going to hate us. We got to go somewhere basically where there's nobody. I offer semi-sincere apologies to the Native Americans. There was an Aboriginal, you know, transient population in the Great Salt Lake. But in any case, they chose a really desolate, arid part of the United States, the Great Salt Lake Basin. And Brigham took them through unbelievable hardship, you know, took people from the Mississippi River across a series of mountains to present-day Utah.
What drew you to this story, Alex? Why'd you write this book?
Why did I write this book?
Yeah.
I was invited to write this book by an editor. I wanted to plug him. He's a graduate of Lexington High School named Benjamin Adams, a resident of Lexington, Massachusetts. He was an editor at Bloomsbury, a terrific publishing house. And he thought if we could get a trade book, a popular history, if we could get the right writer, this could be a great book.
Was there any – do you have any interest in the subject matter before he approached you?
I did, to be honest.
Why?
I got to be really, really careful. The greatest name in Mormon history, in my opinion, is a woman named Fawn Brody, who's no longer living. And I knew her family in Los Angeles in 1979. She's Joseph Smith's first 20th century historian. She was excommunicated by her uncle, no less, from the Mormon Church for writing her astonishingly excellent biography of Joseph Smith called No Man Knows My History, which is still in print.
Wow, that's a great story.
It is
a great story. And how did, when she, after she was excommunicated, what happened? She just...
She became Fawn Brody, a UCLA professor of history. I just can't stop myself. I'm so in love with Fawn Brody. She's the first American historian who ever linked Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings in her biography of Thomas Jefferson, obviously not with DNA, you know, using so-called historical methods. And at her death, unfortunately, when I knew the family, at her death in 1979, she was working on and published posthumously a book I haven't read and I doubt is all that good, but got a lot of attention. She published a so-called psychobiography of Richard Nixon.
Now, we're almost out of time here, Alex, so we can't go into
American Crucifixion.
American Crucifixion, we've talked about that, but you have a column in the Globe talking about how writers are going to be broke forever, but maybe that won't be true in your case.
Well, believe me, I'm sure... I did time that for the
arrival of this book.
For the arrival of this book, there really is no money in books, to quote my saint.
Yeah,
father.
Despite that fact, I hate to disclose something in a personal email between me and Alex, but I'm gonna do it anyway. When I say something nice to him about the reviews that I had read, he emails back something in typical Alex Beam fashion. At the end of which, he writes hashtag happy and then hashtag for once, which I think it sort of describes who you are. Yes, congratulations.
Thank you.
Would you like to tell us?
Nice of both of you to take it.
Before you go, the names of any of the other books, or should we just keep those as sub roads for the time being?
By Fawn Brody, by Alex Beam's American
The Murder
Crucifixion.
Of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. It's called American Crucifixion by the great Alex Beam.
And Alex Beam is a columnist, of course, for the Boston Globe. When we come back, we're going to wrap up this open mic bender with Mayor Tom Menino of Boston. Stay tuned for our exit interview with the man who ran the city for 20 years. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio. We're wrapping up our open mic edition of Boston Public Radio with Mayor Tom Menino. He joined us last month for an exit interview.
He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
We have to talk really fast today because it's Cyber Monday, Marjorie. I've got to get to the computer. So joining us in Studio 3 with how many days left?
35.
35. Joining us in Studio 3 with 35 days left is Mayor Tom Menino, soon to be Professor Tom Menino. Professor, welcome to Boston Public Radio.
It's great to be here. Now I'm speaking as an elected official.
Yes.
When in January, I'll be an expert because I'm from academia.
Exactly.
That is correct. Now, Mayor Menino, before you came in here to the studio, I looked to my left, and I saw a person there sticking his tongue out at
me. Totally unprofessional.
And it was you, the mayor of the city of Boston. And I was out in Rosendale on the campaign, and this really obnoxious person, this must have happened to you so many times, this really rude and obnoxious person came up and started harassing you. It was a John Conley, it wasn't a John Conley event, it was a building opening in Rosendale right before the election. She harassed you. She said, Mr. Mayor, and you turned to her and you said, get the hell out of here. Go home to your husband. And I thought, this is a mayor who is free at last.
Free at last. Free at last. Gosh darn, it's been great. Free at last. That woman, her husband, was the leader of the business, the bus drivers union.
The bus drivers. She was harassing about the bus drivers. Nobody had any sympathy.
Don't bother me.
It was great.
She says, you're very arrogant. I said, no. They were arrogant to the school children of Boston. That's what the issue was.
Yeah, no one defended the bus drivers.
They left all the kids on the streets. That's wrong.
So you seem today, you're doing free at last in the hole. You seem totally up. There's a melancholy piece of this, I assume. You've been doing this for 20 years. Yeah. This has been your life. Is there not a piece of this that's a little sad for you, Tom Menino?
Well, it is sad. But, you know, I made a decision back in March. I'm at peace with myself about it. And, I think... I've set a path for the new mayor to lead the city to the next level. That's what it's all about. And I've met with the new mayor several times, and I think he'll put a team together around him that will lead the city to the next level. You know, I left it in pretty good shape, but there's other things we could do in the city of Boston. So I'm happy with it. I'm going over to academia to do some things I want to do, and I'll be involved in the city. I still want to be involved in the schools. I got some ideas about schools that we haven't tried yet. So I want to be there. I'm not going to leave my kids alone.
I want to ask you about those ideas in a second. But first, you said leave the city in pretty good shape. You look like you're in pretty good shape. And you told me the whole, other than your leg, which obviously is still an issue, if you were as healthy then when you went to Faneuil Hall that day to say I'm not running again as you are now, or at least you knew you're going to be in this good of shape a few months down the line, would you have run again?
No.
Why?
I just, 20 years, it was time to go. 20 years is a long time for everybody to be in the office. I said, it's time to turn the chapter of the city to another person. And that was all about, you know, I could have ran, I probably could have won too. But it wasn't about winning. It was about making a new person come in and bring the city to the next level. That's well. And it wasn't about Tom Menino. It wasn't about Marty Walsh. It wasn't about any candidate. It's about the people of Boston and what they deserve. I just want to make sure we have a new slate, new opportunities.
Well, let me me ask you this. When you look back, what's the most fun thing about being the mayor?
Oh, you know, it's easy. Being with the kids. I love being with the kids. I mean, Camp Harborview, which we started 8 years ago, fabulous. Summertime, just being, listen to kids, what the issues are. But also kids know what's going on in the city. They give you sometimes the best advice, best information you need to do your job. That's why I like. I like being out there, listen to, go to the playgrounds, go to the schools. Go to the schools and talk to those kids. Then you ask them for questions. Wow, they have some of the best questions, but also the best information about what's going on in their neighborhood.
Yeah, Tom, say, if you will, Tom Menino, tell, for those who don't know, and I was lucky enough to go out there with you one day, it's a great operation. Tell people what Camp Harborview is, what the idea was, and what they're doing with kids from the city.
Yeah, it's a program we started 8 years ago, kids between 11 and 14, too young to be old, too old to be young. And, you know, they're the in-betweeners. And we had a big problem in the city the year before, and I had an idea about this camp. I called Jack Connors. I said, Jack, I want to take you right out to Long Island. You got this piece of land I want to do something with. Yeah, I said, I want to build a summer camp. He said, what do I know about something? I said, I don't know anything about it. We're going to build one, right? He says, I don't know. So he came back and said, yeah, we'll build one. And we built this camp in 108 days. And we've had 800 kids a summer go there. And we track those kids in the course of the year. We don't just let them go after July and August. We track them. We help them with their education. Last year, we gave 20 scholarships out to young men and women of Boston to get to help them through college. And also, you know, the business community of Boston has been fabulous. And I tell you, Jack Connors, he's done all the fundraising, let me tell you, because I can't do it. I'm an elected official. He's raised about $45 million for the camp and no public money at all.
It was surreal. So kids, speaking of kids, you said there's some things you want to do with education. One, what are they? And two, does Mayor-elect Walsh, has he signed on?
Well, this is an idea that I'm formulating. See, we have two schools in Boston right now who are going to lose their accreditation. And I had a disagreement with the state on that. You know, it's not about just the classroom. It's what the reinforcements those kids get, what they get after school, on weekends, because some of those kids come from the lowest socioeconomic level in the whole state. And you can't blame those kids. You can't blame the school, really. The school, all the schools basically the same. But where those kids get the reinforcements, that's what I want to do, is help those kids who come from those neighborhoods, both of them, one's in Dorchester, one's in Columbia Point, and how they help those kids. I mean, it's unfair to say for the state to come in and say, you're going to lose your accreditation. What is the state going to do to help those kids? That's the question I have. And, you know, they say, well, we're going to send a receiver in. Well, receiver doesn't mean a diddly-dunk. It means, what are you going to help those kids? How are you going to help them? Money and programs. Not just throw money at it, but effective programs.
So can you see yourself working with Mayor Walsh on these issues?
Oh, I think so. Marty and I have had several discussions about schools, about development, about so many different things over the last few weeks. And I think he's going to have the ability to bring the city to deal with those issues. And I'll help him. See, my days are over. It's Marty Walsh about the city of Boston. And I just want to be helpful. Not about me making headlines anymore. It's about how can I help? Because I'll feel so great when I see the city's schools get better and better all the time.
You know, we're talking with Tom Menino, mayor of the city of Boston. Mayor, I asked you what the most fun thing, as you said, meeting with all the kids. What is the toughest thing? I remember seeing pictures of you and your wife, Angela, going into a State of the City thing where you give a speech every year, and you were embroiled in a contract fight with the firefighters, and they were out there yelling at you and screaming at you. And that's going to be tough. I mean, are those kinds of things the toughest, or are there other things that are tougher?
That's tough because of take on my family.
Yeah.
You know, my family didn't choose to be in the spotlight. I did. And that's unfair to them. But the toughest things I have, I always remember, is going to a family's home after the child's been killed. Tina Cherry, I was mayor about 3 weeks. Her son, Lewis Brown, got shot. And I'm running around, I hear the call, and I says to my police officer, I have to go there. So I go there. I walk up the stairs, ring the door. I say to myself, what am I going to say to this woman? What's I going to say to the husband? And he walked in. I said, Tina, I don't know what to say, but I'm here to help you. Those are the things you just, you know, you have to be real about it. And I sat with them for the whole evening discussing, because Lewis Brown was one of those young men in our city who wanted a great future, but senselessly being shot. I've done that a lot of times. A young woman over in Dorchester who was paralyzed, how we helped her out. You know, it's not about, and I don't like my, I did that without any press. It's not about, see, I get crazy about that, how you do it just for the media. It's not about the media. you have an inner soul that says to you, how do I help? How do I help? And that's what I always thought as mayor. How do I help people have a better life? That's what I cared about.
By the way, Lewis D. Brown, was he going to, or had he just been to a peace rally that particular night?
Yeah.
There was a peace rally. He was walking home and sensibly got shot.
A total innocent bystander had nothing to do with anything, and he was killed.
Jim, you and I have been there on the peace walk on Mother's Day.
Mother's Day March for Peace,
See how many mothers and families show up that day to walk for peace. And Tina's been a hero of mine.
Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute. So you mentioned you're entering academia, as you call
it.
You're at BU. Two things. One, tell us what you're going to be doing. And two, I just read in the paper the Institute of Politics at the JFK School, Mr. Mayor, is doing this training for incoming mayors from around the country. How is what you're going to be doing at BU different from what they're doing at the Kennedy School?
Well, the Kennedy School has a three-day seminar, bring mayors and new mayors and have individuals talking to them. What we're going to do with Boston University's initiative on cities. We're going to help mentor mayors on the issues, help them not just the 3 days, but the year round. Help them send people out there to help them with their educational issues, their transportation, financial piece, which is the most important piece a mayor can take on. All those things. That's what we want to do is help them and also come up with and bring people together on each other issues that might be affecting the environmental issues we have out there. How do we work on those issues? That's also important to us and at the Institute. And, Boston University has a lot of programs, but they're not centered in one location. This can be a center in one location. It'll be myself, and I have a co-director who's from academia, and myself. And, it's going to be interesting. Academia and Tom Menino working together, wow. That's going to be a challenge. He's going to understand.
For who? For you or for academia?
For academia. I feel sorry for him. He's going to have to learn my language, and I don't have to learn his. But I met with him several times, and let me tell you, it's going to be exciting for me because I'm going to have graduate students in, have them as interns working on different projects. I've told the students at Boston University at the press conference, they're welcome to have open classrooms with me, come and talk with me. And I offered my services to different professors at Boston University to speak at their classes during the course of the year. So it's going to be very interesting, I think. And it's going to be challenging because they never did this at BU before. And I've talked to Bob Brown several times about it.
He's president of BU,
He's a great guy. He's a great guy.
So Mayor Tomenino, for 20 years, you've lived a fantasy of hundreds of thousands of people who live in Boston. Because you have a driver, you've never had to look for a parking spot. What's going to happen when you're not the mayor? I mean, is it going to be an honorary Tomenino and Angela spot at Government Center Garage? Or are you going to be like the rest of us, trolling around the block with your quarters?
Well, first of all, I drove yesterday for the first time in a year.
Really?
I drove an hour around the neighborhoods just to see how it is.
How'd that go?
Great. I was looking for a clutch in the car. There's no clutch in the car.
Stick shift days are gone for the most part.
Yeah, it's going to be different, but hey, everything changes. I mean, I'm ready for that. I'm going to have to find my own parking space. I understand that. But that's life. I mean, you have to get ready for it. You have to put it in your mindset, hey, on January 6th, my life changes. I go do other things. And it's a challenge for me. And I'll meet that challenge. Because, nothing's forever except death and taxes.
That's true.
And sometimes marriage. Sometimes.
Some people thought you being mayor was the other thing that was
definitely.
Yeah. But Tomenino, when you wake up on January 7th, though, I mean, you're saying the things that I'm sure you want to happen. Don't you worry? But you get up on January 7th. And the world has changed for you. You're a 5 o'clock guy or whatever it is. You're from until you drop at the end of the day. You're running the city's business. You're meeting people. I'm serious. You're not worried about that culture shock?
Well, it's been a culture shock for me. Going to academia, it's a little different. But, I'm going to fill up my time. I'm doing a book. I'm writing a book with
Jack Beatty.
Jack
Beatty. Did you start that yet or no?
Yeah, I've been working on it right now. I'm working on it for the last 7 months, I think, 8 months. And
he's great.
He's
very good. We're lucky to have him. And I got that. I'm going to do work with schools. So I'm going to keep myself busy. I'm going to keep myself occupied. And, I'm not going to – the only thing I'm going to miss is the phone calls when the snow comes.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right.
And also my grandkids, when the snow forecast, and they say to me, Papa, we're going to have school tomorrow? We want to know. Call off school. But I'm going to miss the people the most. I mean, I honestly tell you, folks, that's what I enjoy the most, being out in the neighborhoods, being at different recreational centers, the churches, all that. That's who I am. Nothing fancy, just Tomenino.
What what's your record, by the way, on a certain day of how many events you went to in one day? I mean, I bet you've been to, some days you went to like 15 or 20.
I have. I've done many events, so especially on the weekends, Saturdays. Yeah. I do a lot of events. I used to do a lot of events, but you know, those days are over. It's all over. I still do a lot of events. This weekend, if you have nothing to do, Marge and Jim.
What?
You can ride the trolleys with
me.
Oh,
the Christmas trolley. I love that.
We do 20 Christmas trees on the weekend.
She'll tell me how it was, okay?
I did that one year. It was fun.
I don't want Marjorie to be denied the joy of this, Tom.
How about Hyde Park? How long have you lived in Hyde Park?
All my life.
All your life. So you have no interest in, like, relocating to the Back Bay or anything?
No. Why would I want to do that?
I don't know.
I got my mortgage paid. Yeah. What? I got a beautiful little house in Reedville.
Yep.
You know where Reedville is?
I do know where Reedville is. Hyde Park, there's no good way to get there.
That's right.
It is a pain in the neck to get to.
I have no reason to move. I mean, I got a nice little house. Great little neighborhood. My friends are all there. You know, one thing you got to remember who your friends were before you became mayor and who will be your friends after you become mayor.
That's a great
point.
Got
a lot
of
folks who call me up now on January 7th, they lost my phone number. I understand that. I understand that now. And I just got to, I'll deal with it. I mean, I have a lot of good friends.
Hey, Tommy, one thing you're not going to be going to do after January 6th, even though you were hoping to, is visit a casino in East Boston. Obviously, the people in East Boston rejected it by 12 points. Now there's either potentially Everett, maybe Revere will get back in the mix. What's your take on what should, if Steve Crosby, the head of the Gaming Commission, were to give you a buzz and say, what do I do now that East Boston is no longer the front runner? What's the best choice for Eastern Massachusetts and for Boston, by the way?
Well, I think sometime today, the Revere proposal will be announced with Mohegan Sun as the operator of the casino. I still think it's a good site, but I think how do they put it all together so quickly? I mean, that's the question. They still have to have a host agreement. They also have the surrounding communities agreement by the end of January. How do you put that all together? Will the suitability of Wynn and Everett, because the stories we saw about some of the landowners, that's another question there. You know, the deal we cut, we negotiated with Suffolk Downs.
And Suffolk Downs.
Was a great deal. Even, you know, even when we went so far and put a letter of credit in there. Nobody's ever seen a letter of credit in an agreement with a casino. I did that because I want to make certain that the money they promised me will come this one way or the other, either through revenues of theirs or through the letter of credit. And, you know, they made a decision in East Boston. I'll stand by the voters of East Boston making that decision, and let's go forward. But the other thing is I don't want Suffolk Downs to become a strip mall. That's the issue. And also just used as a parking lot. That's another issue.
Were you surprised to hear Bob DeLeo, who's the Speaker of the House, who not only is from Winthrop but represents Revere, part of Revere, that he said, I'm not sure that the Revere proposal is, and I'm paraphrasing, but essentially was not a full-bore endorsement of this recast proposal. Were you surprised to hear DeLeo say that?
Yeah, but I know what context he said it. I mean, I know Bobby is afraid of casinos. I don't know why he said it, how come he said it. You know, we all have our own ideas. I mean, and you know, the thing is, if we're going to have casinos, let's get the best one that creates jobs and creates revenue for the state and this locality. That's what the most important is.
Are people going to go to Everett, though? I mean, let's assume. I mean, Everett clearly is the front runner for Eastern Massachusetts. So no one knows if Revere will get back in the mix. Are people going to go? The goals you had, even though I know the top of your list was East Boston, are people going to travel to Everett to do this thing?
I question that. I question them going to Everett. But, you know, suitability, that's the issue that still has to come up. And they haven't made a decision by the Gaming Commission. They made it, I think, Tuesday, Wednesday this week.
Mayor Nino, Boston Magazine had you on the cover, I think, of last month's issue. They called you the greatest mayor in the city of Boston. They also said you were petty and thin-skinned and had a short fuse, and the prosciutto was flying around the fifth floor of City Hall. Is that true?
Not prosciutto, no. Not these days.
Okay. Something else, perhaps?
We have all green stuff.
Oh, green stuff. Okay. The broccoli, Brussels sprouts.
Broccolis. We have ribbies. No more prosciutto on the fifth floor. Let me tell you.
Okay.
We're boring as blazes when it comes to eating these days.
Okay. You have a short fuse?
No.
No? That's not what I hear, Mr. Mayor.
Oh, good.
I hear you can get a little ticked
off. Of course I can.
Yeah.
You would, too.
I would, too.
You probably do with some of those articles you write. Oh, my God.
Absolutely true. How about the smoking thing? You were really an anti-smoking crusader. Did your parents like
subject
you to
cigarette smoke?
Well, why
don't you be clear here that I am totally with them, and you are the outlier on these issues.
Well, you must hear this, Mr. Mayor.
Stop stuttering about the issue. Now just tell her where you are.
Okay.
Now stop fooling around. You for or against?
I am for smoking sections. I'm not for no smoking in Boston parks. I'm not.
I'm totally with you, Mr. Mayor. I want to make that clear.
But you have been big on this, and you grew up in an era where everybody was smoking like a furnace. So where did this come from, this anti-smoking zeal?
Well, I saw over the years that people I know who smoke get lung cancer. The health was deteriorating, and I saw that, and I read all these studies about it. And, it was convinced me. I mean, friends I knew who got lung cancer and respiratory issues if they were smoking.
But what about the little old ladies over in Marion Manor that want to go out at 85 and have a little cigarette in the porch? They can't. They're going to have to take the trolley down to, 500 feet down the street.
See, you're one of those individuals who just want to exaggerate the fact.
Exactly. That's exactly right. What I've been saying for like 15
right.
years. Take it away, Mr. Mayor.
Exaggerate the fact. Should they go into the little porch and have a cigarette? No problem. As long as they don't do it inside.
Okay.
That's what. So you have that air, that smoke blows away and nobody inhales it. So, in the old days when you had smoking, wait staff would inhale 2 packs of cigarettes in 8 hours.
Yes,
that's
true.
Yeah, bad. That's bad for you.
Yeah.
And so we had to step in and do something.
You know, in addition to the smoking crusade, Tom Menino, one of the things you've been on a crusade about both on your own and with a former Medford guy who is now the outgoing mayor of New York City is obviously guns. I mean, it's pretty clear that no matter how tough the gun laws are in one state like Massachusetts, if in New Hampshire they're weak, it's meaningless. So it's all about the feds. But there's no real hope in the short term that the federal government is going to do anything about this, is there?
That's right. Jim, it's 500 mayors who signed on to Mayors Against Illegal Guns.
How many is that again?
500.
500.
Just think about that. That's almost every state in the union. There's enough constituency to stop. But the NRA, they run the Congress. It's so unfortunate. This is not about gun control. It's about crime control. That's what this is all about. And I just get so sick and tired of those guys in Washington, all of them. Our guys are good. But after that, you need a national policy. I think we're the only industrialized country in the world that doesn't have a gun control issue.
So if there was a referendum, I know it's not permitted, but they've polled on this. We've talked about it a lot on the air. If there was a referendum, Mr. Mayor, because everybody says they love their own member of Congress, but it's the others that are the problem. If you could vote for or against the national referendum that would change all 535 of them at once, would you vote for it?
Yep.
You would? Yes, you would?
Yeah.
How about that, Marjorie? Again?
Just smiling ear to ear.
No, I am so – I mean, I like my congressperson too and all that kind of thing. So, Mr. May, you started this whole discussion. Marjorie, you said to Marjorie, now I can say whatever I want. I don't have to worry about the voters. So I'll ask you again when I asked you on TV a few weeks ago. Who'd you vote for?
It was a private vote.
I understand that, but you can say whatever you want.
In America is a secret
private
ballot.
Vote.
Who'd you not vote for?
I didn't vote for myself.
No.
I don't vote for David Ortiz either.
Mr. Mayor, when it does come time to move out of City Hall, you must have dozens of great pictures in your office. What are you going to do with all those pictures? Not going to fit in your little house in Hyde
Park.
Well,
I'll probably eBay make some money on them.
Yeah.
I just tell you.
I mean, you got pictures with presidents. You got pictures with ball players. You got superstars.
And let me tell you, I sent some to go with me to BU.
Yep.
Some will go to my Hyde Park library. Some will go to the archives in the city of Boston.
Okay.
Angela says none of that stuff's coming home. That's for sure.
Okay.
You want a plaque? I got a plaque. Anybody in the city could have.
What's
plaques
that?
Plaques for everyone. But, I just, it's the outpouring of folks in the city. It just amazes me. I mean, just let me tell you, Jim and Marjorie, I'm the luckiest guy in the world when it comes to that. When I was sick, the outpouring of folks... prayers and cards and get well. I mean, wow. It's a great city. Let me tell you, you got to just keep making sure it's an even better city in the future.
Well, when you were a kid growing up in the city, and I know loving the city as a kid, what were you hoping? I mean, Marty Walsh talked about how, what his dreams were, and this is, by comparison, insane that he's not. What did you want to be when you were a kid, Tom Menino?
When I was young in high school, I didn't pay attention to my studies at all. Play sports, that's all I cared about. And my father was, elderly Italian, and all I cared about was education. I disappointed him then. And I always wanted to be a social worker. I always wanted to do work with people. And And my father could never understand that. But that's what I wanted. I'm doing it now, and I'll continue to do it as my next life.
When did your father die?
Right after I got elected city councilor.
And so what would he, if he had seen his kid sworn in as mayor of the city of Boston, what would that have been like for him?
He wouldn't believe it. That's for sure. He wouldn't believe it at all. My dad was just a guy who worked at Westinghouse in High Park. And, you know, he was my hero. The reason I got elected the first time because of his popularity. He used to play ball in High Park, great baseball player. He used to walk High Park Avenue every day from his retired, up and down, talking to people every day. The thing is, when I decided to run for city council, I said, Dad, I'm going to run for city council. He says, you can't do that. I says, why can't I run? Because you're married, you got two kids. What happens if you lose? I says, Dad, I'm not going to lose. Don't worry about it. I'm not going to lose. And my words are true. I didn't lose, and my father was happy and so proud of me. And I wish, you know, today that he was around in the glory of my days as mayor. But he's up there watching us because I know if everybody went up there to visit heaven, he's the only guy I know went up there because he was the best guy in the whole world.
Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Our show is a production of WGBH.